Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a newsworthy conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. News, what are we reading or seeing on the news when it comes to drugs? Well, it depends on where you get your news from. Are you a Fox or CNN fan, or do you get your news from TikTok and Instagram? So I did a little experiment. I went to Fox, and on the search, I put in drug crisis, and this is what I got. Want to stop smoking for good? CDC launches a new campaign with free resources. Ketamine therapy shown effective in treating severe depression in veterans. Crisis in the Northwest. Rural Oregon struggles to contain fentanyl epidemic. I did the same with CNN. Search drug crisis. Nearly all hospital pharmacists say drug shortages are negatively impacting care. Scroll, scroll, scroll. Everything is about pharmaceutical drugs. That's not really what I'm looking for. Change the search to overdoses and got overdose deaths continue to rise in the U.S., reaching another record level. Now TikTok. Put in drug crisis and see our country, our choice. More than 1,500 Americans are dying from fentanyl each week. Right after that, all drugs should be legal. After that, a video of bodies laying on the street with zombie apocalypse in a homeless encampment area. It looks like on a street of Kensington, Washington, D.C. So to learn more about the news, I reached out to a person who writes the news, a journalist, Eve Simmons. Eve Simmons is a British writer, journalist, and health and wellness editor. She interviewed me for a story on California and marijuana for the Daily Mail, so I decided to interview her back. She's written several in-depth reports on cannabis legalization, including the California legalization market, babies who died because of marijuana, and recently covering the Bryn Spacer manslaughter trial, where marijuana was at the center of the trial. To learn more about Eve Simmons, check out the High Truth show notes. Eve Simmons, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
I'm very excited. I've been looking forward to meeting you in person and asking you all the things in order to get the scoop. I want to get the scoop on what it's like to be a journalist. You're a journalist and health and wellness editor. And so I was hoping you could take us behind the scenes of what that's like.
Behind the scenes of what that's like. Well, so I work for dailymail.com, which is a big website. It started in the UK. So I started at the newspaper version of the website in the UK. And now I'm working online. It's a very fast paced operation. We do between sort of 10 to 11 health and wellness stories every day. They could be anything from a new study to a kind of more in-depth investigative piece about something we've been working on for a long time, to, I don't know, you know, is reform or Pilates worth doing? So a bit of everything, really. And I head up the wellness channel, which has just started, which is very exciting. And then also dip in and out of health, and I have a background of health reporting. So I am involved in a lot of the kind of investigative pieces that we do and the more in-depth stuff, and have lots of my own areas of interest, which I'm not exploring as much as I have been before, because I've only just started. Well, I started in October, so sort of still getting under the table with everything a bit. But it's very busy, basically.
Yeah, and that's a lot of stories, and some of them are, like you said, like quick little snippets of, you know, about Pilates or diet fad, and some are very investigative reporting.
Yeah.
And tell us about, in general, you said newspaper, where I don't know who's reading newspapers anymore.
Don't tell me about it. It's a travesty.
an older generation, right, still have. But I think the new generation get their information from TikTok, Instagram, you know, whatever online sources. So how do you compete with all that?
Oh, that's a good question. We try and join rather than do something different. So we have a very big presence on TikTok and on Instagram and on Twitter. But we have great, very clever online data people who can give us information about where our readers are, how our readers are coming to the stories. And then we use that information to kind of optimize the stories that we do and the way that we sell them. So, you know, how they're headlined and that kind of thing, to make sure that they're going to spark the interest in the reader. So we do a lot of that. I am an optimistic journalist. I think that great stories and, you know, important stories are always going to be vital for a functioning society anywhere in the world. And I think that the general public do hold that to be true and do value that. So I think although print journalism is obviously sadly dying, I still think there's always going to be a place for really good, valuable stories, news stories that are proper news, and are found and written by brilliant, talented reporters. And I think whether that's online or in print or on a newsletter or on social media, people are always going to come to those stories. It's just how you them for the different platforms, really.
How do you tell as a consumer, as a reader? They say, you know, the old, well, that's fake news and that's real news, that's just sensational. How do you know when you're reading a story whether that's real, fake, or just sensational?
It's a really good question. I'd say it's especially challenging in the field of health, because you know as a physician that academic work is often interpreted in very different ways. Mm-hmm. You can have a study which, if it's read by somebody who isn't a scientist like me, thinks that it means one thing, but in fact it means something completely different, or it's just one study done by one set of scientists in a very small group of people, and so therefore from that study you could draw one conclusion, but reporting it to be fact is actually not factual, because that's not what science is. So I think in the field of health, for the layman, it can be really, really difficult and a challenge. And I would say my rules are always be careful of the associations. So like if there's a very obvious association and there hasn't been a randomized controlled trial, or there hasn't been a cause and effect that the researchers have even theorized, then stay away from it or take it with a big grain of salt. And also, you know, is it published in a peer-reviewed journal? Has kind of well-respected colleagues of the researchers been talking about it on Twitter or on, you know, in any other forum? I generally like to look at the doctors that I trust what the doctors think more than I trust what I think or my fellow journalists think. But, you know, the long and short of it is it's very difficult. It's very difficult. But you have to be curious, ask loads of questions, check out the sources, make sure there's not just like one expert saying one thing. You know, I'm sure you know this, but certainly in health, I'm always quite wary of the kind of one issue scientists or the one goal researchers who seem to be kind of trotting out the same thing over and over and over and over again. I feel there's an inherent bias there. So I always try and find someone else who's a bit independent to check it out. But yeah, I think it's a constant and ongoing problem that I'm trying to do my best to make right.
Right. And also there's the interpretation. Like, I just like, for fun for this show, I put in a search of drug crisis. And one of the things that came up was ketamine, good for depression. And I could see how the public will take that to mean, oh, let's start all using ketamine, I'm depressed, instead of, wait. This is made for like doctors and dosages and specifics. It's not meant for like everybody should be on ketamine now.
Totally. And as we've seen in the past with these kind of experimental treatments, you know, they may start as one thing being exciting and a small group of researchers maybe making it their baby. And so there's stuff in the press about a few small studies that have been done. But right. Actually, like, as we know, science and medicine is an accumulation of knowledge. And it's really important that we don't kind of jump on something really early, because it could be that in 20 years' time, we learn that it's actually a complete disaster.
Right. I learned that being 30 years as a physician, I've seen these fad treatments for whatever, congestive heart failure, heart disease, and then, you know, especially weight loss stuff, and then the consequences. Oh, oops, you know, these people are getting pulmonary fibrosis. We didn't know that was going to happen. So I'm not one to jump real quick on new treatments till I see what the consequences have been.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a balance, I guess, because in the UK, we're very cautious. Mm-hmm. So we have the NHS, and for anything to be approved on the NHS, it has to go through this extremely rigorous process. Right. And it's often criticized for being, backward and too time consuming. And it means patients miss out on treatments that are potentially helpful. Whereas here, it's a completely different attitude. And obviously you guys have the insurance system. So,
But I think we have the same FDA process, right? And the same critique.
Our FDA process is the same as our MHRA process, which is like drug approval. But then the NICE approval is cost effectiveness. So that's it's even more rigorous. It's like an extra layer of your bureaucracy, which is constantly criticized. So it does mean that often there's drugs here that cancer patients, for instance, can get access to that you can't in the UK, which are proven to be effective. So, I find it really interesting being here that to work out what that balance is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like end of life care, experimental care, that, you know, there's a little looser guidelines on for that. Tell me about the Daily Mail. So it was a newspaper, but now it's also a tabloid, but also online webs. And I'm pretty amazed that you have 11 stories a day. That's a lot of stories, way more than I ever expected.
Yeah, that's just how we also have science in our team, which is probably another like 5 or 6. Yeah, interesting. Okay, so the Daily Mail is probably, I think it is the UK's biggest daily newspaper, most sold daily newspaper, I think. Around for, I'm embarrassed that I don't know when it was founded, but many, 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 many years.
Hundreds of years ago, right?
And we have a daily paper and we have a Sunday paper. I worked for 7 years on the Sunday paper, which if you work on a Sunday, you get a little bit more freedom to work on some, perhaps you have more time, basically. So the Sundays have traditionally been famous for really investigative reporting, all the big scandals that come out and that journalists spend months and months working on usually come out of the Sunday papers. So that's what I did. And the Daily Mail particularly has a really good name for its health content. We're really good at extrapolating very complicated scientific information and making it digestible to the average person. The Daily Mail is one of two of the biggest tabloid newspapers in the UK. So the other one is The Sun, which is seen as a little bit more down market than the Daily Mail, I guess.
What does tabloid mean? Tabloid means gossip or?
You guys don't really have a tabloid culture. It means, what does it mean? It's the New York, it's similar to the New York Post. So really simple language. I guess, it, you know, seen as for the kind of working person to simmer down very complicated news into something that you can read on your lunch break.
But it doesn't mean tabloid sensation gossip, like what the movie stars are doing.
No. I mean, the Daily Mail online, we have a reputation, I guess, for leading with showbiz news. We've always had excellent reporters on the ground who have brought biggest celebrity stories. And so I guess, you know, in some ways that's seen, interpreted as being salacious and sensationalist, but I would argue it's just celebrity news that people want to know. So yeah, online we do have a big, our showbiz content is probably the biggest presence, definitely online. But we, over the last 10 years, we then started coming out to the US and putting out content online. So we don't have a paper here, we just have online. And that's built and built and built. And we've just got more and more readers as the years have gone by and expanded. And a couple of years ago, they launched a big health team. And now we've just launched our wellness content. So it's always growing and expanding.
That's interesting. And so your audience is not just people from the UK or Europe. You have an international audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Worldwide. We also have an Australian contingent. So we've got an office out in Australia with journalists running a whole operation out there. But yeah, we're read all over the world.
Yeah. And you recently moved to the United States. So obviously a strong presence in the US.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We have an LA contingent as well. So we're based in New York and in LA.
That's great. And you're adjusting to life in New York compared to London?
I am. Yeah. I have to say that the public transport system is not as, it's not as comfortable as it is in London. So I am missing the padded seats slightly, but New York is like the best place on earth. So yeah,
I'm glad you enjoy it. So I want to get to some of the stories that you wrote as a journalist. I think I met you when you did the story July 2022, and the title was How California's Legal Cannabis Dream Became a Public Health Nightmare. Great headlines. I guess your smart people made the headlines. I don't know if you did, but tell us about that study, because I was really impressed that this was not just like, you know, interview a couple people or write a story. You did a lot of research and you came out here, talked to different people, moved around. It was in depth. It didn't sound like what I thought a tabloid sensational story would be. You did a lot of research.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that, the Daily Mail has a reputation, I think you kind of alluded to it with our show business content, for being this sort of very tabloid, simple operation. But actually, especially when it comes to our health content, you know, we've always prided ourselves on being incredibly forensic. And I had that opportunity on the Sunday paper more than I would do in any other kind of contingent, just because it's too fast paced on the dailies. And yeah, so I wanted for a long time, I've been very interested in legalization and the effects of legalization. And for a long time, I wanted to do a big piece on it. And so I spoke about this with my editor, and we decided that the best thing for me to do would be to go out to California and speak to doctors. And it happened because it was at the time the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, had done this big kind of PR stint where he'd gone to LA and visited some of the big cannabis factories and the pot shops. And there were these big photo ops of him in this like absolute crowd of marijuana plants looking, I guess the argument was he was trying to look like he was really in touch with the young generation. And the line was that he was considering legalization in London, which, number one, he would never have the power to do that because he's just the mayor. And number two, was just like completely ill thought out. He was obviously just saying it because he thought that was going to make him popular with young crowds. And so we thought this is a perfect opportunity to see, well, has it worked in California? What's the benefit been? And would we see a similar effect in London? And as a health journalist, you know, I was very neutral about legalization. Always, I guess, maybe it's just my nature as a journalist, I never really make my mind up about something until I feel like I've accumulated enough evidence to make an informed decision. And as a health journalist, the thing that I'm always most interested in and most concerned about is the health implications of any sort of legislation that's going to impact, you know, how people feel and how well they are. And all I could see from doctors, coming out from doctors, especially emergency physicians, was that this was becoming a real problem and that they were seeing increasing numbers of multiple different health problems related to increased marijuana use, which could be directly linked back to legalization. And so I went to LA, I met a number of doctors, including myself, and tried to get a picture of, you know, the extent of this issue. Was it a kind of simplification to just pin it on legalization? Are there lots of other things going on that are causing this? And I felt a piece like that, there was no way you could do it in a simple way. There's so many different interesting nuances to this story.
Did you visit dispensaries also?
I did, yeah. I went to a dispensary. I went to two dispensaries. One that was kind of she and almost looked like Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop. Like, you know, it was ridiculous. The amount of money people spend in there. They have like the like dishes with the weed and these like gold plated things and like weed soap. And like, I mean, it was like walking into some sort of wellness joint. It was very bizarre. And then the other one I went to was like a big kind of almost like factory downtown, not a very nice part of town, where they were selling like wax and dab for like with like 95% THC or something. Wow. And then I also spoke to families who have been affected by either marijuana addiction or feel that legalization had a negative impact on a loved one because they became involved in smoking too much or it had a negative impact on their mental health for some reason. And I try to be, you know, I looked at a lot of studies, sociological and psychological and medical and, you know, everything that I could find to give me, you know, so I could understand the data and the evidence and be swayed by the facts, basically. And it just seemed to me that it was all pointing in the same direction, which was that we thought this was going to be a great thing for lots of different reasons, and actually none of those things have come to fruition. There has been very little benefit, for California anyway. But there's been these huge risks and a lot of downsides that perhaps aren't really taken into consideration or taken seriously. And it's only when you really look at the data and these huge increases in hospitalizations for psychosis and schizophrenia and cannabis-induced hyperemesis. I don't know if I've said that right.
Skromiting. I call it skromiting.
Exactly, yeah. I actually called it that on Twitter and people thought I was mad. As well as like DUIs, etc. Yeah. So, or maybe they're not DUIs. Are they DUIs?
Yeah. Driving under the influence, DUID, driving under influence of drugs. Driving, yeah.
And it just seemed to me that this was wild, that all this was happening and you can't ignore these huge spikes. They weren't subtle differences. They were big and noticeable. And plus you have the doctors saying, we're really worried about this and it's only going to get worse.
So in your article, did you describe what you saw? Did you make some conclusions? Just to...
Yeah, I did. I concluded that legalization has been... It was really difficult to say that cannabis shouldn't be legal. But what it is easy to say is that it should be highly regulated. Mm-hmm. And the way that it's been legalized has been totally irresponsible and inappropriate and not thought out properly. I still think that it's madness to send people to prison, obviously, for smoking marijuana. However, what message does it send to the public if something is legal? It sends this implicit message that it's safe. And from everything that I could see, it's not safe. It comes with very serious and significant risks, especially the high potency stuff, which is what everyone is using now.
Yeah. What was legalized medically in 1996 and then recreationally, that has been genetically modified and altered to, the voters did not vote for that, right? They voted for the Cheech and Chong weed. They didn't vote for these dabs and chatters, and that's 95% potency that behaves like methamphetamine, or these candies that babies are attracted to.
Totally. But I think subsequently, I've obviously been really interested in the topic. And even, you know, the relatively high strength weed that people are smoking in like bongs or whatever, I think it's this normalization culture that's also a problem, because it means that although you might not be doing like a wax or a dab or anything that seems particularly ridiculously high strength, mm-hmm. it means that you might be open to doing it more often, or, you know, it becomes part of your lifestyle. And right. we know that the more that adds up, it has more damage on the brain and the personality and mood and XYZ. And I think that we just have to be, you know, very mindful of messaging when it comes to public health. It's so important.
How did you see when you came to California and did your investigation and compared to what you were living in at that time in London, what was the difference? Because people say, well, it's been legal in Europe for a long time.
Well, it's not in the same way. You won't go to prison for smoking marijuana in London. You might go to prison for dealing it if you dealt like a lot of it, and if you were found to be growing it, and etc. But the difference was the culture, that there's a real culture which is growing in the UK, I think related to what's going on in the States. Mm-hmm. But the culture in California was very much like, you know, it's not even, it's spoken about as if it's coffee. That there's no risks really, and if there are risks, they're tiny, and you're ridiculous for even talking about it or bringing attention to it.
And are they selling these high potency products and these candies and gummies? And
they have started to. I think there's been a few reports of like big increases in the potency, the average potency of cannabis products, or like just seized by police and that kind of thing.
Yeah, do they have better protections against children though, like making these candies that look like, you know, Oreos and Cheetos? And
I guess the main, also a big difference, is we don't have pot shops, you can't sell it. So there are edibles, but it's difficult to get hold of them, because it's not like you can just walk into a shop and buy them. You know, you'd have to get it on the black market, and then, like, you know, you'd have to then introduce a dealer into your home, and most people, they have children, they don't want to do that. So
interesting. So what was the feedback on this article? Like, did a lot of people read it? You probably have statistics, like how many viewers, did it get around the world, or was it
did it
meet the highlight?
I don't have the statistics to hand, but I know that I very, very kindly, the powers that be at the company gave me a bottle of champagne because it was the...
That's a good sign.
Yeah, it was the best trafficking story of that month or something, I think, which means it did pretty well. It was, I mean, my Twitter like exploded.
Did you get hate mail or?
A lot of it. It was mostly hate mail. Yeah. Our readers.
Were you scared?
Was I scared?
I mean, it's unpleasant to get people who hate, you know what I mean? Like you're doing this as a health reporter to give science out and for people to hate on you. It doesn't feel good.
I think what it showed me was how unpersuasive the facts are, which is very, you know, deeply concerning, that as a journalist, you're obviously only concerned with the facts as you know them to be, and the testimony of doctors and scientists and medical professionals who have been doing this stuff for years. And that just didn't seem to be persuasive to hundreds and thousands of people. I think if anything, it was a concern for the state of my industry, society, everything, the world, more than kind of my own safety. I mean, it was unpleasant. I remember I tweeted out the piece and then the piece went live and I tweeted it and then I got straight on the plane to fly home. So of course I didn't have any signal access to anything for 11 hours. And then as soon as I landed and I turned my internet back on, it was just like my phone was just going off. I had thousands of notifications from people. They went onto my personal Instagram. They found pictures of me and my then partner and commented on the pictures saying I was a bitch or whatever. Yes, really horrible comments, and also from like some very high profile people in the UK. It did the rounds and they sort of tweeted saying this is a load of rubbish or, you know, laugh.
It's really hard to be ahead of the curve. I've learned that, you know, when I've been around for a while. So when I started talking against freely prescribing opioid prescriptions, which seems ridiculous now, right? But I was, you know, like, you're not compassionate. You don't know what you're talking about, right? And now, you know, with history, that was the right move. And sometimes when you're way ahead of your times, it can be painful.
Yeah. And especially with this, I mean, I'm a very, you know, I've voted Labour my whole life. I'm a left-wing person. I always have been. Very, you know, free-thinking, liberal-thinking about every topic, really. And so it was strange for me that it was like one thing cancels out the other. Like I couldn't be highlighting these like very concerning, alarming facts that are coming from people who really know what they're talking about. And also, you know, believe that people shouldn't go to prison when it's unnecessary. I think there was maybe a sort of prejudgment of my personal views, which really had nothing to do with it.
But it's a very charged topic, and mm-hmm. you'll meet people where their addiction is talking to you, right?
A number of people that commented that were very clearly like, you know, sat in a dark room with the curtains closed, and
yeah. So you know, when I looked up. I looked up Daily Mail to kind of learn and prep for talking to you. And the Wikipedia page for the Daily Mail had Wikipedia controversy, October 2011, Tamara Cohen. I don't know if you know her, one of your reporters, but she published an article that said just one cannabis joint can cause psychiatric symptoms similar to schizophrenia as well as damaging memory, which is, it's true. It doesn't mean everybody who smokes a joint is going to get a psychotic episode. But that's just fact. And that's fact based on studies of 7 million people. So these are not little studies. And yet, like right there in the Wikipedia page, and Daily Mail was criticized by groups of Cannabis Law Report, calling them prohibitionists, you know. And I thought, but it's a fact. It's that shouldn't even be disputed.
Totally. Yeah. And it's interesting because it's like, this is the same group of people. I find it's like the pro-cannabis lot who speak very loudly are also the same group of people who are very kind of anti-fake news and will, you know, accuse outlets, including the Daily Mail, of peddling fake news and not being consistent with the
science. I know, like science. I was like, wait, but not for marijuana?
Yeah, exactly. The one topic where that just doesn't apply.
So the next article you wrote, or that I saw, I'm sure you've had like, you know, 11 a day in between, but you have a lot. But November 2023, there's an article that came out and the title was "From 18-year-old who shot his girlfriend's baby while high on marijuana to stone babysitting who let two toddlers drown. We reveal how cannabis has led nearly 300 brutal child deaths." And again, very impressive. This is not like, oh, you heard or talked to this one guy and you wrote this story. This is another one of these stories. Maybe tell us what kind of research and time went into publishing such a thing.
So this one was actually very difficult to do. I was approached by a contact who had been collecting these reports from local newspapers, various court documents, etc., of deaths of children that involve marijuana. So that arrived on my desk. And obviously I was aware that the contact that brought this to me was a very prolific anti-legalization campaigner. So I did a lot of work to make sure that I checked out every single one of the cases that was in this report, went back to court documents, went back to local authorities, etc., to kind of corroborate everything that I had. And it basically all checked out and found more cases as well, and probably more, but there were a lot of them that were kind of, we couldn't 100% say that it was definitely a link, so we left it out, but it was likely to be more. And unfortunately kind of found lots of the more details about the stories as well, and images of the children. And some of them, I mean, it's very varied. Some of them are stories where the parent there's a history of neglect, and it's quite, you know, saying that marijuana had this huge role to play in the death of the child is perhaps pushing it slightly, because you could argue that this child was in danger anyway. But nevertheless, ultimately marijuana was the thing that tipped it over the edge.
Was it just marijuana, or maybe also some fentanyl and some methamphetamine and other things?
Some of the stories were other drugs involved as well, but a lot of them, it was just marijuana. I can't remember what the percentage was, but there was a fair few. And some of them were parents with no history of any wrongdoing at all, seemingly healthy, normal upbringing, and had a psychotic episode induced by cannabis and had done something terrible. The case of the babysitter was particularly horrific because...
Tell us about that story.
So I don't remember the specific details, but I think the story was that she, when she was a younger woman, she was babysitting for a friend's child and had got stoned and taken her off the ball, and the child had run out into a lake and drowned and died. And the same thing happened. It may have been the other way around that this happened before, but anyway, the same thing ended up happening to her daughter. She was stoned, the daughter ran off and she lost her, and eventually she ended up drowning and died.
So it wasn't because of psychosis, it was like she was too high to pay attention.
Yeah. So in some cases it was I don't know if that is classed as neglect, but they're too high to pay attention, basically. And the doctors that I spoke to have told me that this is something that they see not often. So that they're familiar with this phenomena of of being too high to, you know, pay attention, which obviously if you have a toddler, anyone with a toddler will know. Yeah. You have the time. So I think those are the cases that kind of get me the most, because it makes you feel like it could happen to anyone. And again, this normalization of a drug that has very significant effects on a person's mood and reaction times, etc., should be, you know, shouldn't be the case that it's not a big deal to be smoking it around your toddler, in my opinion anyway.
No, like you would think you don't even need a warning label, like don't get high while you're babysitting.
Yeah, but it's so, like, you know, it's now being used as a treatment for stress or anxiety. Everything.
Yeah. So how long did it take you to do all that research? That's a lot. 300 cases you found, you know.
That was the best part of a week. It was about a week.
I'm looking at, okay, so a lot of research. And did you get pushback, and were you called mean names?
That one I did actually. And I think that's probably because children were involved. And usually when child deaths are involved, people don't really have a lot to say, because there's not really much to say. And we were very transparent about the fact that, you know, these weren't all cases of, as we just discussed, someone getting high and just forgetting. But there were some. I mean, there was one case of a young boy in his, I think, early teens. He was about 14 or something, and he was looking after his girlfriend's baby, and he had a gun, and he was high. He got high in the car and then dropped the gun, and the gun went off, and the baby got shot. Horrific. I mean, you could argue that another part of, you know, the other problem in terms of, you know, big legal issues in this country is that guns are legal. So that was also part of the problem. But nevertheless, if he hadn't have been stoned, perhaps he would have been more careful.
Yeah. Or lock up your guns next to children. That's responsible gun ownership. The other one, the thing that you did recently is a Bryn Spacer manslaughter trial. And give us a little background and tell us about what you thought about that.
Yeah, so Bryn Spacer, I came across her in, I think it was round about, quite soon after I'd moved to the States. So it was roughly October, end of October, beginning of November. So she's a young woman, originally from the suburbs of Chicago, relatively recently moved to California. And she, the story was, she dated a guy for about a month. They were friends dating. She was an audiologist, incredibly successful and bright and ambitious young woman. Not a regular marijuana user, but had used it in the past. She met this guy she was dating. There was one evening where she went to his condo and he offered her a toke on his bong, which he, it came out subsequently in the trial that he used it quite often. It was sort of a feature of his living room. It was sat there a lot of the time. She had a couple of tokes on this bong, and it sent her into a complete psychotic episode. And horrifically and tragically, in that episode, she proceeded to grab a knife and stab her romantic interest friend, who she had been getting on well with. She proceeded to stab him. His name was Chad O'Melia, to death over 100 times. She then stabbed her dog, who was also in the room, and herself in the neck twice, and ended up in a coma. She was saved because police got there just in time and actually had to hit her, I think it was 9 times before she grabbed and she let go of the knife, which sort of is testament to her, how serious and all-consuming this psychosis was. And she was subsequently tried for murder, although the charges were changed later on in the trial to involuntary manslaughter. And I was, I say, lucky enough. I don't know if I want to say lucky, because the case, the story itself is not one of luck. But it was an incredible experience to be there. I went to cover the sentencing last month. in Thousand Oaks in Ventura, which was a really sort of actually quite life-changing experience for me. Something
that really, tell us how about that.
Yeah, I mean, I felt very connected to Bryn's story because she's my age. So I'm 32, she's 32, just turned 33. She is ambitious and trained to be an audiologist because she'd had hearing problems as a child. So she'd always been interested in helping other, her career was dedicated to helping other people who had been through a similar struggle to what she had. She'd faced a huge amount of difficulty in her life and was kind of reaching the peak of her career as a young woman. She'd relatively recently qualified. She'd got this great position at UCLA. She was helping children to get their hearing back or to cope with being hard of hearing. Had a great big group of girlfriends. I mean, there was lots of things about her life that I really felt was sort of almost a parallel to mine, which I know you shouldn't do as a journalist. You have to say objective. I was objective, but you kind of can't help but be interested. And I guess my intrigue as a journalist, as a curious person, was how could this have happened to somebody who was... She had a great long history of being a sort of model citizen from a nice family in the suburbs of Chicago, you know, ambitious and creative and successful. And suddenly in 1 second, she just does the most, you know, unimaginably horrific act. It was just really intriguing to me as to how that could happen to a person.
That's what psychosis is, right?
Well, and the more you, I think also I've had a history of my own personal mental health problems, and I've had a long history of reporting on mental health problems and being very involved and interested. And so I have always kind of fought in my reporting to take mental illness extremely seriously. And I've also always been really interested in the acute end of mental illness. Having had personal experience of a psychiatric hospital, I'm very kind of, you know, aware that we talk about mental illness a lot, but actually there's a type of mental illness that isn't talked about that much, but should be. And I felt that, you know, that also kind of spoke to my interest in that area, because you could, you know, it was obvious how serious this mental episode she'd had was, psychiatric episode rather. And also then, you know, the whole cannabis thing. And I was aware of, having spoken to doctors, of how this can happen. And so it's like seeing it in real life.
Yeah.
And going to the sentencing was really difficult, but also like exhilarating, just as a journalist, because it's a fantastic story to witness. Because you can't help but see these two families just completely ripped apart. And the only conversation between the families, understandably, is you know, attributing blame to a person. And I can only imagine what that feels like to be faced with the person who's brutally killed your child. But as humans, you know, we want to blame a person. We want to have a scapegoat. We want to say it's your fault. And I watched her throughout this sentencing and just really felt for her, because there was no way anyone could listen to that medical evidence and all of the testimony from the psychiatrists and the people who have been studying cannabis for so many years, and her history of being a kind of, you know, modern, model citizen with no history of any crime and or violence or aggression, and you know, come away from that sentencing thinking it was anything other than this drug that has caused this to happen. And I just couldn't help but feel that it's so terribly sad that these two lives that were so young and full of hope and all the things that they could have done, that they wanted to do, and dreams and loving families and so many people around them that absolutely adored them, and both lives have been essentially cut short in one way or another because of a drug that people think is safe. So, yeah.
I think the trial brought out the fact that cannabis-induced psychosis is a real thing, right? You know, both prosecution, defense agree that this is what happened to Brynn. And you could tell that this was a one-time episode, and because now on trial she seems normal. You know, she, that's how, you know, and with continued use, you could see how that could become permanent, right? That's the conversion from just a psychotic episode to having permanent schizophrenia. And you could see how that happens if she kept having episodes like that, how that can convert. Do you feel, watching that, probably looking at both families, you're right, your heart, I mean, two lives have been destroyed. One was taken away and the other one was destroyed. Was justice served watching the trial and watching the sentencing? So the jury convicted her of involuntary manslaughter, and you were there for the sentencing to see what the judge decided. Watching that, did you feel like justice was served in the American way? Would it have been different in England?
I think it's really difficult because what is justice when no one is really at fault? I mean, physically and in the most kind of, you know, basic of senses, I guess you could say she is at fault because it was her hands on the knife and it was her who committed that crime and did those actions. But if you're not if you don't have your capacities and you're not in control of your actions, which is what the judge said, she didn't have any control of her actions.
Mm-hmm. But what would you say to people who are under the influence of alcohol and commit a crime, or methamphetamine and commit a crime? They're not under their faculty. They're not themselves. Their brain is also hijacked. Is it the same thing, or is cannabis gets a different slant?
I think that's the kind of ultimate question, isn't it? I think with alcohol, you know what you're doing if you're, I mean, for one, you know.
But people think they're fine. They feel like that's a problem with drugs, is that your perception of being okay and what other people see of you is not the same. Mm. You feel like you're okay. Like there was a study of drug drivers, right, with a simulation model, right? Mm. And you'll give marijuana to people and see, do you feel like you're okay to drive? Like, yeah, I'm fine. But the data shows that you're not fine, right? But your perception of yourself driving is fine, right?
Yeah.
That's just simple with driving. Let alone, you know, the psychosis that could happen when you're under the influence.
I guess the thing with the thing is we know, I mean, I don't know, but from what I understand, that when you drink, alcohol-induced psychosis is not possible, or it is, but it's very rare.
Well, it happens in the older brain, right? We see cannabis, alcohol-induced psychosis, and it's common. Like if you look at, you know, the CDC data, oh, look at all this alcohol induced psychosis. It's called Korsakoff psychosis. These are people who've been, you know, drowning their brain in alcohol over many, many years, and they have like a dementia kind of from alcohol and vitamin deficiency. But when you get drunk, you don't like get psychotic and start hearing voices and seeing pink elephants. That happens with long-term alcoholism. Alcohol is a water-soluble drug. Marijuana is fat-soluble, so it goes straight to your brain, which brain is fat.
Mm. I think it's the knowledge issue as well. And I guess also with Brynn Spacia, the case was so unique because she had such an obvious history of never doing anything wrong and not being a criminal and not, you know, and only wanting to kind of serve society well. And that was so obvious, you know, there was no way that she could have faked that. And so the judge said, you know, this is a unique set of circumstances where that you can't really make a comparison because, you know, maybe somebody who was dabbled in methamphetamine for however many years and had multiple, you know, repeated episodes of doing terrible things on the drug, but still continued to take it. There was also some question as to Chad O'Melia's use of marijuana and to what extent he
may have had a cannabis use disorder.
He may have had a cannabis use disorder, but also on that evening, there's discussions as to, and completely not kind of, no conclusions made, mm-hmm. but as to, we know that he was the one that gave Bryn the bong, and we know that Bryn had said that the first tote wasn't doing much for her, mm-hmm. and he had said, I'll get you some stronger stuff. So, you know, perhaps if legalization wasn't a thing or normalization wasn't a thing, mm-hmm. You know, he may have thought twice about offering somebody who was clearly inexperienced a stronger potency drug. We'll obviously never know that, but
right. But you shouldn't have to be killed for that, making that mistake.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's not even, yeah.
Some of the comments, like, you know, when you do your story in the comments and the backs, some of them, like, the people who should be sitting in jail are, you know, the industry that refuses to put warning labels, or the state legislators who are promoting and refusing to pass consumer protections and allow these high potency products, no warning labels. Like, the public doesn't know about that, right? The public doesn't understand the risk. And even probably reading this story, they're saying, oh, well, that's just a weird case. And it's not a weird case, because I read this story and thinking, wow, that's sensational. And it is sensational. But in the emergency department the other day, I had a woman who stabbed herself in the neck, hearing voices. She was extremely psychotic, and she had to go, to the trauma surgeons for her neck, and she had to get sedated, and it was all marijuana. And so we see cannabis-induced psychosis on a daily basis, maybe, you know, not a murder like that, but violent episodes is not unusual.
Yeah, I interviewed Chris Mahondi, who was the expert witness who was actually, funnily enough, brought in by the prosecution, who ended up, his testimony, I think, pretty much, changed the whole way that the case ended up being played out. And he was very much, you know, yes, this case is obviously uniquely tragic and horrific in the way that Chad was killed, but not surprising and not uncommon. And I said, oh, obviously these cases are rare. And he said, he pulled me up on that and said, no, these cases aren't rare.
Oh, I'm glad. See, I'm not the only one. No. He said that it's not rare.
Forensic psychiatrist, and he's been doing this type of thing and you know, being giving evidence. Yeah. Multiple cases for years and years, and says this is something that we're seeing a lot and we see more often.
Right. So, right. But on the other hand, and I don't know with this, on the other hand, what message are you sending to the public by not having serious consequences of taking someone else's life, even if it was, you know, while your brain was hijacked on drugs?
I think that is an obviously a take that I've heard a lot. I would argue, what are the risks and benefits here? You know, the risks of that message to the public, you know, really, I think for anyone who understands this case and is a sort of logical, rational person, you know that that's not what this is saying. That's not what this message is. The judge said many times over, this is a very unique case. There are several factors that have influenced his decision that are very important to take on board. And it's not the case that it's setting a precedent or setting an example at all. That's not how it works. And, you know, that was made very, very clear. I think the risks of sending somebody like, you know, a young person with her whole life ahead of her, who, you know, really was just so incredibly unlucky. That was her crime, that she was incredibly unlucky. sending her to prison. The risks are, you know, remarkable. That there's no question that that's going to, I mean, her life is already destroyed, but it's even more destruction for her and an entire community around her.
Yeah, she's not a risk to society.
She's not a risk to society, exactly. Yeah, and exactly. And the question is, why do we put people in prison, right? Do we put people in prison to set an example? Do we put people in prison to send a message to the public? Or do we put people in prison to keep other people safe?
Or to pay for your crime.
Yeah, to pay for your crime. But I think with this case, it's not as cut and dry.
It is. Yeah, it's an important story too, I think.
I think so. And I totally understand that, you know, some people would say, you know, if you take a life, you take a life, and no matter what the circumstances are, you must be punished for that. I totally understand that. And I'm not sure whether, if I hadn't been at the sentencing, I would have been more on board with that than I am now. I'm not sure if I would have been as defensive of her, I guess.
Did your publishers give you a champagne bottle for this one too?
No, I didn't get a champagne bottle for this one, unfortunately.
All right. So you work on a lot of stories. We went through just some of them. Do you have a favorite? I read that you like even dress up, you know, fitness fads and other things for your stories. Do you have other things that you, other subjects that you enjoy writing about?
I enjoy writing about. Yeah, loads. I've written a lot about eating disorders. That's kind of my other specialist subject, I guess, and mental health in general. What else am I interested in? I've done a lot on disability. It's all quite bleak and boring, unfortunately. Well, not boring, but depressing. Yeah, I've done a lot on disability. What else have I done? I do a lot of like taking down anything that Gwyneth Paltrow says is good. Or, you know, wellness fads that are quite obviously nonsense. Do a lot of myth busting, that kind of thing.
That's fun. So, and what are you working on now? 11 stories a day. I still can't get that, Adam.
Well, I'm the editor. I run the section, so I'm not writing them. I report.
I don't know if I read 11 health stories a day, but yeah.
Yeah. What am I working on now? Loads of things. Like it changes every day. So we've done today, and then tomorrow will be a new day.
Wow. Amazing. All right, the Daily Well. So, and then finally, what advice do you have for people who they feel like they have a story that they want to get out? What's your way of getting attention for a journalist to grab your story?
Find them on Twitter. If they're a good journalist, they'll be on Twitter. Find them on Twitter. Journalists, the one thing that I have learned in my career about journalists is that they love to be flattered. And they love to be told they're great, and they love it when somebody wants to get in touch with them. So just get in touch with them, just tweet them, find out where they work and go and say hi. They'll love it, and tell them what your story is. And there you go.
There you go. Well, in that vein, Eve Simmons, I think that you're an amazing journalist, and you have such in-depth worth, not just multiple stories, but really getting to the science, looking at all the facts. I'm really impressed on how much effort. It's not just a super official story that you do. And I so appreciate the time that you came and shared with us here on High Truths.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And you're the doctor. You're the one with all the stories, really. We just write what you say.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.